I'll leave you to read 1 Kings chapter 18 yourselves. It's quite a long chapter, but do have a read of it before listening to this. This is the account of a confrontation of gargantuan proportions. A solitary Elijah takes on the 450 prophets of Baal. How many times has it been played out since? Our heroes of the silver screen are extraordinary characters like James Bond and Jason Bourne, who emerge triumphant against the heaviest of odds. Arnold Schwarzenegger takes on the better-equipped Predator or the vastly superior Terminator and amazingly prevails. Or beyond that masculine relish for blood and guts, you have the patient campaigners like Gandhi or Erin Brockovich, driven by moral outrage, who take on the institutions and corporations and win. It's great stuff, and many of us wish we could be the heroes. I grew up watching epic feature films like Quo Vadis, telling the story of the fire of Rome in the year 64 CE and how the psychopathic Emperor Nero blamed the Christians for it. They were duly sentenced to defend themselves against a bunch of very hungry lions. The Apostle Peter had left the city shortly before the fire, but then he was met by an angel with the question, Quo Vadis, Latin for where are you going? Your brothers and sisters are facing the ultimate test, Peter. You need to be with them. And so in a dramatic finale, as Christians await their fate in the arena, Peter cries out from the stands, here, where Caesar rules today, Christ will reign forever. Peter is executed for his pains. It was powerful stuff back in the day, but of course cinema has moved on. And of course, we know that not every hero has such a memorable denouement. Christian history is tinged with the blood of countless martyrs who are not remembered for their natty one-liners as they exited this life. And some do remarkable work in very understated ways. But we love to be inspired, and this was Elijah's finest hour. How long, he said, will you limp between two opinions? If Yahweh is God, follow him, but if Baal is God, follow him. The choice was stark and unmistakable. So I want to draw two lessons from this story today. We need to have clear heads and strong hearts. We need clarity and we need courage. First of all, clear heads. Funnily enough, we don't know an awful lot about Baal. We know he was a rain god and that his consort Astarte was a fertility goddess. We know that the ancients would make idols of wood and stone and that children were sometimes sacrificed and their bodies cemented into a new bridge or building to win the favour of the gods. All very primitive stuff and light years from where we are at today. Yes, you still get the druids and some weird goings on, but on the whole, we're nothing like that these days. It may come as a surprise that the only thing we knew about Baal before 1929 was what we had in the Bible, which is a bit like being in court with only the prosecuting counsel there to present the case. And the Bible doesn't have a good thing to say about Baal. But then in 1929, the 3,000-year-old Ugaritic tablets were discovered in Syria. And suddenly we had a defense counsel. And as scholars looked at the worship of Baal, it seemed strangely familiar. So much so that Eugene Peterson, who put the Message version of the Bible together, wrote an article in 1992 about what he called Neo-Baalism. He defined it as me-driven worship. Baal worship, he said, was entirely focused on satisfying people's needs. When you were terror-stricken, you offered a sacrifice. When you were anxious about the crops, you made a visit to the temple prostitute. When you were joyful, you ingested the wine god. It was about pleasure, not pain. Neo-Baalism, said Peterson, complains when we don't get anything out of worship. Neo-Baalism lets feelings call the tune in our services. We may be entertained, warmed, diverted, or excited in such worship, but, he observed, we will probably not be changed. The late American preacher A.W. Tozer said much the same thing. He depicted the conversion experience as Jesus coming to us cap in hand, looking for a job. We look him over, run through a cost-benefit analysis in our minds, and then if he's lucky, we offer him a place in our lives. What twisted theology. Jim Wallace, the founder of the Sojourners community, said we have misconceived conversion as Christ coming into our lives. rather than us coming into his life. Think about that. The devil's greatest trick is counterfeiting. I used to work in a bank and sometimes took in large amounts of foreign currency. In my experience, most forged US banknotes were very convincing, except for one or two crucial differences, and we were trained to spot them. Satan's not going to tempt you to join some other religion. He's happy enough if you settle for a corrupted form of your own, but which lacks the one vital ingredient, paying attention to God instead of myself. Obedience to God's word lay at the heart of Old Testament religion. As the prophet Micah expressed it, we're to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God. Baalism didn't do that. It taught you to love yourself above anything else. Religion in Israel had become a comfort rather than a challenge. It appealed to the senses, but it didn't call you to change your ways or to do anything about the woes of the world. I don't doubt that this is where many people start when they come to church. They're looking for comfort and often they find it. But this isn't where we should end. We are called to higher things, to be agents of God's kingdom. And so Satan will keep you in church and his temptation will be smart. And you'll go to a service and your number one question will not be, how is God calling me to be different? Or how does God want me to live my life? But rather, did I enjoy myself today? Was the service to my taste? Elijah was clear thinking about this. He understood the fundamental difference between the worship of Yahweh and Canaanite worship. He knew that Canaanite religion was hot on blood sacrifice and cool on self-sacrifice. We need to remember the meaning of repentance from the French word penser, meaning that you have a radical rethink. So clear heads, first of all, and then secondly, strong hearts. When you distill this story down, there are three parties: Elijah, Ahab and his prophets, and then the people. And the people have weak hearts. We're going to cheer for the winner, they say. What we need is people who not only think clearly, but act courageously. People like Elijah who will take risks for God. People who will not go with the flow if the flow is going in the wrong direction. But actually, what we all too often have is people who delay committing themselves until they see how it will all pan out. You've probably heard the saying, I used to be indecisive, but now I'm not so sure. Alexander Hamilton said that those who stand for nothing fall for anything, and George Bernard Shaw stated that courage is not the absence of fear, but the mastery of fear. But the people of Israel were hedging their bets. Even though Elijah had been right about the drought, there were 450 prophets of Baal and only one Elijah. So they thought, let's wait and see. Whereas what we need is people who've done the thinking, understand what this is about and come out hollering for Elijah now. We need decisive people who think clearly and feel strongly. It could be said that the US president feels strongly, but I don't think he was thinking clearly, or maybe he was. At the start of last week, he ran the Secretary of State for Georgia and pressurized him to change the election result in his favor. Then he told his supporters that they needed to be strong in the face of election fraud. I'm sure you've all seen what resulted from his brazenly irresponsible words. Five people died. Interesting parallels were drawn between the police treatment of Black Lives Matter protesters and Trump supporters. And many of those supporters were unrepentant and were threatening either revolution or civil war. But well done to the Secretary of State for Georgia, and indeed Vice President Mike Pence, for not being browbeaten by this narcissistic president. He was a bad loser, not a courageous leader. By contrast, biblical and Christian history has been littered with men and women of great courage. Read the story of Micaiah in 1 Kings 22. See what Jeremiah and Daniel and his friends endured. Measure the courage of John the Baptist and the unwavering devotion of Stephen, the first Christian martyr. Pause at the cross and understand that Jesus knew full well what was coming to him. He could have tempered his words, kept his opinions to himself, but he had a strong heart and a determination to fulfill his destiny. Martin Luther King echoed the final days of Moses on the night before he was shot. I've been up the mountain and I've seen the promised land, he said. I may not get there with you, but mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. When the Roman Emperor Constantine became a Christian, the empire began to change. But it took a long time, and certain practices continued for almost 100 years. It was a tradition that on New Year's Day, gladiators would gather in the Roman Colosseum and fight to the death. 80,000 people would crowd into the amphitheatre to witness the spectacle. The emperor would preside, and the gladiators would bow to him and declare, "We who are about to die salute you." On the 1st of January in the year 404, the main actors were in place. But on this occasion, there was another man in the crowd, a monk called Telemachus. And he shouted out before the fighting began, "For the sake of Christ, stop." He was ignored and laughed at by the majority. But when he climbed down into the arena and started to try and intervene, continuing to shout those words, "In the name of Christ, stop," the patience of the crowd was quickly exhausted. They picked up large stones and started to throw them at this helpless monk. After several heavy hits, he collapsed to the ground, and then a gladiator finished him with his sword. This story has been recounted at several points throughout history, some accounts more gory and flowery than others. But each raconteur recalls that there was a pause as the crowd realized what had just happened. Then gradually, one by one, they began to leave the stadium. The 1st of January, 404, was the last time this bloodthirsty event was ever held, thanks to the courage of one extraordinary monk. We cannot make ourselves into martyrs, but we can develop strong hearts. Years ago, a Christian preacher was taking meetings somewhere in the US. Afterwards, a young man rushed up to him with his notepad at the ready and asked, "What's the secret of Christian leadership?" Without even pausing to think, the preacher turned and replied, "Bent knees, wet eyes, and a broken heart." May we nurture such devotion in our own hearts. May we be perceptive in our analysis and passionate in our response. May the spirit of Elijah, the same spirit that drove Jesus, be the driving force in our lives as well. Clear heads, strong hearts.